At Baptist Health South Florida, it's our mission to care for you when you're injured or sick and help you stay healthy and fit. Welcome to the Baptist Health Talk podcast, where our respected experts bring you timely, practical health and wellness information to improve your family's quality of life.
Forgot where you put your keys again? No biggie. Forgot to get eggs at the grocery store? Not horrendous. These are common memory lapses. They happen with age. Absent-mindedness is one common and often unavoidable downfall of getting old. But when you have a noticeable memory difficulty, like forgetting what you just read or experiencing confusion about where you are, your loved ones start questioning your lucidity. Then words like Alzheimer's or other forms of dementia become part of the discussion. Here to talk with us about the confusing nature of Alzheimer's is Dr. Raphael Wald, a neuropsychologist from the Marcus Neuroscience Institute at Boca Raton Regional Hospital, part of Baptist Health. And of course, I'm your host, Dr. Jonathan Fialco, Chief Population Health Officer for Baptist Health. Welcome to the podcast, Rafi.
Hi, John. How are you?
Doing well today. I appreciate you taking some time and sharing your expertise and passion for Alzheimer's disease and other neurological conditions with us today. We've thrown these terms around even just on the intro, Alzheimer's and dementia. Can you start by just telling us, from a clinical standpoint, what is dementia? And then maybe what are the forms of dementia? Specifically, then we'll get into Alzheimer's.
Sure, absolutely. The technical definition of dementia is that a person has an impairment in their memory and at least one other thinking skill. So that means a person can have problems with their memory and their ability to see things in space, their ability to sustain focus on something, their ability to juggle information in their head and kind of give it back to someone in an altered form. We call that executive functioning. So dementia is essentially a description of a cognitive impairment, of an impairment in thinking skills. Anytime someone says the word dementia, that's what it means. It's talking about a person's thinking skills. And then there are many, many things that can cause dementia, by far the most common of which are Alzheimer's disease and vascular dementia. So Alzheimer's disease is a cause of dementia.
So dementia is the overall clinical condition. And then when one sees a neurologist specialist, it's, well, let's figure out what would be the cause would be to address, obviously, what the prognosis would be and what interventions would come into play. So let's talk about Alzheimer's in particular, since that's the purpose of the podcast, though we might touch on some vascular dementia as well. From a layperson, for example, the question becomes, when is this, we call them, if I could use the medical term, a brain fart? When is it something that's a transient type of episode versus a pattern that can become more problematic? What would be the early signs of Alzheimer's that one would experience and or, I guess, family members would see in others, that are more common?
Sure. Yeah. I mean, the hallmark of Alzheimer's disease, of early Alzheimer's disease, is amnesia. So it's memory problems. That's the first problem most people experience. But there's also aphasia. People can have word finding difficulties. That's also fairly commonly a first sign or symptom of Alzheimer's disease. And in a portion of people with Alzheimer's disease, the first symptom is depression. So it can look different depending on the person. That's kind of why you need a doctor in order to help with that, in order to tease out what exactly is going on, because maybe it's depression, maybe it's a first symptom of Alzheimer's disease. But I like to say, it's all relative. So in other words, when people come in and, a 70-year-old asks me, how do I know that these times when I have problems coming up with a word or remembering where I put my car keys, how do I know that's not dementia? And I say, well, think of it this way. So you probably can't throw a baseball as far as you could when you were 30 years old, right? So your brain is not going to work as well as it did when you were 30 years old. So some decline is normal. Our bodies don't work the same way they did 40, 50 years ago. But, the question is the aging happening at a rate that we expect, or is it happening faster than we would like it to?
That's a wonderful analogy, and I'm going to feel free to steal that when I lose the patients, but it's quite true. So do you find that most patients self-present to you with symptoms that turn out to either be Alzheimer's or dementia or not? Or is it mostly family members that say, I'm concerned, or people say my family's concerned? Do people notice it on their own, or do others notice it more frequently?
So the doctor's stereotype of the presentation of a person with Alzheimer's disease is that the person comes in with a family member and they do not realize that they have memory problems, but the family member is noticing the memory problems. So the patient has really poor insight into what's going on. Whereas a lot of times the stereotype with vascular dementia, which I mentioned very briefly earlier, is that the patient will have insight into the problems that they have, memory problems. But of course, unfortunately, nothing fits neatly into a Tupperware container where, you know, everything looks exactly the same way. We have many, many patients that realize they have memory problems and they have Alzheimer's disease. We have many, many patients who don't realize they have memory problems and have vascular dementia. So a lot of times the patient realizes there's an issue. Sometimes they have difficulty seeing it. So there really is a range of appearances and levels of insight that people can bring.
So in follow-up, I'm going to ask you a loaded question, because it's loaded because you can answer it in many different ways. But when should someone or a family member seek professional evaluation? And the second part of that is, and what does that evaluation look like?
Sure. My answer to that is anytime you're concerned. I mean,
that's why it's a loaded question.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, anytime you're concerned, because you know, hopefully the result of it is that, you know, your concern was just a little bit of anxiety and everything's fine. That's the hope. But, you know, there's nothing bad that will come of the evaluation. If we do find that there is an issue, now you're getting a jump start on treatment for it, and getting a jump start on putting into place a lot of different behavioral sorts of daily activities that hopefully we can do to keep your memory functioning at its best. So in my opinion, the best time to address it is if you have a concern, let's take a look at it and see what's what.
Yeah, great. So low threshold, no to be embarrassed. We don't want to add anxiety to people such that, as you say, every time they forget where they put the keys, they're making doctor's appointments. But at the same time, if someone is noticing something of concern, get it checked out by a professional as quickly as possible. No downside, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And the other thing that you had asked me was what the process is like. Right. So the typical process is that a person will come in and see a neurologist, and the neurologist will order a standard set of tests. Generally speaking, there will be an MRI of the brain. There will be, which is sort of like taking a picture of the inside of the brain from the outside. Then there's an EEG where little sort of sensors are put on the outside of your head. It's a completely painless test. And they sort of measure the electrical activity of your brain. There's generally blood work if you haven't had any recently, and the blood work is helpful in ruling out reversible causes of dementia. Like I mentioned earlier, there are many, many, many causes of dementia, some of which are reversible. So the blood work is helpful in ruling out any reversible causes of dementia. And then finally is the neuropsychological test, which is where I come in. And my job is to ultimately make the diagnosis, to take a history. I will do a very brief physical exam sometimes if I need to, and I will do testing of your thinking skills. And based on all that information that I gather, I can figure out exactly what's going on in the brain and make a proper diagnosis and make recommendations for your care.
And I appreciate that final part. That is a unique aspect of what you bring to the table. There's lots of mechanical things we can use, like scans and blood tests, and they're part of the assessment, of course, but you know, the role that you have really is of significant importance in determining what is going on and what's the best opportunities for mitigating the consequences or improving things, right? So that's very helpful. Let's get back to Alzheimer's a little bit in specific. So we know that dementia in general, Alzheimer's, it's more likely as one ages, but unpack the term early onset Alzheimer's, both in terms of what it means and what we see and how frequent it is.
Sure. So by definition, early onset Alzheimer's disease is Alzheimer's disease that onsets before the age of 65. So, you know, there really isn't any in between. You know, if you look at the technical diagnosis code that doctors use, there's early onset and late onset. So if it's before 65, it's early onset. If it's after 65, I'm sorry, if it's before 65, it's early onset. If it's after 65, it's late onset. The way to think about it is that with every decade that we age, the chances of developing dementia increase exponentially. Okay, so when you're in your 50s, the chances are near astronomical, but it certainly happens. You know, a little bit more probably than you might think, but it's statistically speaking on a global scale, the chances are very small. And then once you get into your 60s, it jumps dramatically. We'd say, you know, there's been a lot of research on this, but we'd say probably your chances of developing dementia in your 60s are around 10%. And then once you get to your 70s, it increases exponentially from there. So that's kind of the way to think about it, is that with every decade that you age, your chances of developing dementia increase dramatically.
Is the pre-65 early onset, post-65 late onset, is there a differentiation in the cause or in the treatment, or is it just a differentiation in a sense that it's unfortunate that someone at a younger age becomes cognitively impaired?
So people under the age of 65 that develop dementia generally are more likely to have a genetic contribution. So they're more likely to have family members that also have Alzheimer's disease. There are a number of genes at this point that have been linked with Alzheimer's disease that we don't need to go in right now because it'll be very jargony. And
it's fascinating, quite frankly. And again, as we talked to offline as a lipidologist, I know a lot of them seem to be related to cholesterol dismetabolism and whatnot. But I agree with you, it might be a little deeper detail than we want here.
Yes, absolutely. But generally speaking, people that have an earlier onset of Alzheimer's disease, generally, you'll find that they have family members. There's some kind of a genetic contribution to the onset of the Alzheimer's disease.
So do we have a sense of what causes Alzheimer's? Do we have a sense of what's going on in a physiological manner within the brain or in the various cells of the brain? Or is there a good sense of what causes Alzheimer's, or at least what's found in patients with Alzheimer's?
Sure. The most commonly accepted cause of Alzheimer's disease is the appearance of these abnormal bodies that start to appear on the brain. They're called plaques and tangles. So these are the abnormal bodies that we see in the brains of people with Alzheimer's disease that we believe are killing small parts of the brain as they appear and are causing the disease to happen and to progress. In reality, the truth is it's probably more complicated than that. There's probably a role of inflammation. And then the question becomes, what is the connection between the inflammation and these abnormal bodies that show up? Why do these abnormal bodies show up much more frequently in people that do have Alzheimer's disease and people that don't have Alzheimer's disease? Hmm. The body's ability as we age to defend itself against things that when we were younger are not a big deal, things like free radicals, becomes more and more challenging as we age. And I don't need to go into detail about free radicals and antioxidants and all of that, but essentially your body's ability to prevent bad things from happening to your brain is kind of declining as you age. And because of that, these abnormal bodies have the ability to flourish and start to appear on the brain. And they typically commonly will get together in typical areas of the brain that we associate with Alzheimer's disease, like the memory centers, but very frequently we see those memory centers fairly intact, and we see other parts of the brain starting to shrink into itself a little bit. So there are different ways a brain can look if a person has Alzheimer's disease. There's not just one kind of classic.
So multifactorial, you said many factors contribute, haven't found a particularly identifiable single one, genetic factors, and there are physiological findings that one finds on the brain of people with Alzheimer's at various levels. So with that, and you mentioned inflammation, and again, going back to my world and lipid and cardiovascular prevention and whatnot, some refer to Alzheimer's as type 3 diabetes, and I think we're referring to this inflammatory condition of one's lifestyle that can lead towards medical disorders, which include Alzheimer's. So to that end, what have we found? What do you recommend that one may do when they're younger, for example, to decrease the chance of developing Alzheimer's, whether they have a family history or not? What are the dietary exercise component? What would you generally say to healthy lifestyles to decrease the chance of Alzheimer's as you get older?
Sure. So there's good news and there's bad news. Okay. So bad news first is that with, like I said earlier, as we age, the biggest risk factor for developing dementia is increasing age, and we're going to keep getting older. The bad news is that's going to keep happening, and we can't do anything about getting older. The good news is that the second biggest contributor to the development of both Alzheimer's disease and vascular dementia. Again, those are the two most common causes of dementia, right? So the next greatest contributor to the development of those causes of dementia is what we call vascular risk factors, right? So in other words, if you can work with your vascular risk factors, you can help yourself, you can decrease your likelihood of developing both Alzheimer's
and vascular dementia.
That's the good news. What that means is exercising, I recommend to people, always with a partner preferably, and making sure that you're safe and you're not at risk of falling. But I love to see people take a walk for 30 minutes a day, 5 days a week. So getting exercise, managing your diet, a healthy diet. What a lot of doctors recommend is the Mediterranean diet. So that's foods that are high in healthy fats, foods that are rich in antioxidants, fish, green leafy vegetables. So healthy diet, exercise. And then beyond that is managing your vascular risk factors that you already have or are at risk for. So what that means is high blood pressure, high cholesterol, diabetes is a huge one. Diabetes, thyroid disease, sleep apnea, these are all vascular risk factors, and you want to make sure they're being managed adequately. So that means you want to go to your doctor and have your regular checkups. You want to have conversations with your doctor about your blood pressure and about your diabetes status. And you want to make sure you're staying on top of all of those things. And all those things, the diet, the exercise, the vascular risk factors, those are by far the most important things that we can do to prevent dementia. And if a person has dementia, to slow its progression.
It's very well stated and somewhat poorly understood. So I appreciate both you as a podcast guest and elaborating on this. I'm spending a lot of efforts building a good prevention disease management, you know, program and enterprise-wide approach, for example. And when I tell people, well, what are we preventing? Well, you know, inflammatory disorders, heart attacks, strokes, heart failure. And then I add cognitive decline. And it's not really well thought of as cognitive decline as being a result of the same type of underlying lifestyle and inflammatory disorders. So again, I appreciate very much, you know, you from your angle, from the neurological component and bringing that to light. It's really important. So a couple of other quick questions. Again, this is great detail, and we could go on a much more vascular biology and, you know, physiology conversation, which we won't bore the listeners with. But, you know, let's go back to things that are more practical from a family standpoint. So, you know, when patients start having these confusional states, the tendency of family members is A, to get frustrated challenge and almost argue with the patient and or correct them when they start saying things that are not exactly, based in reality, let's say. What would you recommend to family members in how to deal with people that are showing some evidence of cognitive decline beyond, you know, getting them checked out and getting medical care for them?
Right. So I'm a neuropsychologist, and this is the side of me that's a psychologist where, you know, with the neuro side of it, most often there is a right answer and a wrong answer. And with the psychology side of it, there isn't always a right answer and a wrong answer. So when it comes to dealing with loved ones that have dementia, you can't say there's a one size fits all answer to the behavioral issues. So in other words, there are some people that have family members that have Alzheimer's disease and are agitated because of the Alzheimer's disease, where if they can redirect them or if they can correct the issues that they have with the memory, you know, they can fill in the blanks with the person's memory. It's a, no, mom, remember, we went to this restaurant yesterday for lunch. There are some people that will kind of appreciate that and can accept that, and it's helpful to them. And then there's other people with Alzheimer's disease that will become combative and angry when they're being corrected, when they think that something truly is right in their own mind. So you can't go with a one-size-fits-all answer to, do I correct my mom or my dad? Do I not correct my mom or my dad? You have to know your parent or your loved one who has Alzheimer's disease, and you need to kind of roll with the punches around that. Everybody's a little bit different. There are some people with Alzheimer's disease that become very, very agitated, and there's some people with Alzheimer's disease that become very docile and become very easy to get along with. So it kind of is on a case by case basis.
Do you actually work with families as well, or is it mostly you're working with the individual with the disorder?
Yeah, absolutely. It's important to work with families because a lot of times you don't know that you're getting a clear picture of exactly what's happening. So it can also be helpful if a person is very early on, it can be helpful to get two different sets of opinions on things. Sometimes I see people with early dementia who do a better job describing, you know, their own mood. You know, are they feeling depressed? Are they feeling anxious? More so than their family members do. So it's really important to get multiple points of view on things and to include family members in a person's care.
Two last simple questions, then we'll wrap up for any final thoughts you may have. You mentioned depression as a very frequent and sometimes underrecognized early sign of someone who might be developing cognitive decline. Do you find the medical community is pretty aware of that? Do you get a lot of referrals, let's say, from primary care or from others, or is there work to be done in that space? And I'm not impugning anyone. I'm just trying to get a sense of, you know, how well established that is.
I'll be honest. I do think that doctors are doing a really good job, in my opinion, in that area. I think that they're recognizing depression pretty well. I think that it's being treated quite well. I think a lot of people are surprised to hear that the overwhelming majority of antidepressants are prescribed in primary care and not by psychiatry. Right. So, you know, that means that primary care physicians are getting a lot of excellent experience in prescribing antidepressants, knowing what is working for their patients and knowing what is not working with their patients. I think what's important for a lot of people to realize also is that when a person does have dementia, very frequently, the insight-oriented therapies like talk therapies, we say cognitive behavioral therapies, don't work quite so well. And, you know, I think that's for obvious reasons that, you know, the person can't keep that insight and take it with them and utilize it on a daily basis. It's much more challenging for them. So it really does put it on the shoulders of the doctors to prescribe medications and the family members as well to get the person moving, because the more a person can exercise, the better they're going to feel psychologically.
Sure. I do agree. I think the primary care community has done an excellent job and really at the tip of the spear when it comes to recognizing depression, treating depression, and whatnot. And I would assume as well, they're recognizing when there's evidence of cognitive decline. And that's what the listeners should realize. That would probably be your first line of evaluation for you and the family members in many cases. My last question is, so let's talk about the present and future. What's in development? What are you seeing as opportunities towards treatments for Alzheimer's, or whether it's medications or what? Where do you see the opportunities as medical providers coming for us to help patients with Alzheimer's?
Without getting into too much boring detail, there are two types of medications that have been around for quite a long time that do give people somewhat of a little boost cognitively when they have dementia. And there are two more medications that have been approved fairly recently, that are a completely different class of medication that are more focused on those abnormal bodies that I described earlier. Mm-hmm. They kind of focus on breaking up those abnormal bodies that show up in the brain. A huge thrust of the research is focused on those abnormal bodies, the plaques and tangles. You probably hear that a lot, plaques and tangles, that are focused on breaking up those abnormal bodies that show up on the brain. I wish I was seeing scientists covering more bases. There is research in a lot of other areas going on for sure, but it does seem like the obsession of the scientific community is on what we call these monoclonal antibodies, which are aimed at treating these abnormal bodies like they're some kind of an invader, like a virus, and breaking them up. So my opinion is that Alzheimer's disease is a very complicated illness that can't just be defined by one, you know, issue like a plaque or a tangle. It is multifactorial, and we need to look at it from a lot of different standpoints.
Well, clearly, the more we understand, the more we're able to develop, treatments at the various targets. And I think that's what we're all seeing as an evolution in this area, which is interesting and exciting. And again, I appreciate your efforts and dedication towards managing patients with this complex condition. So our guest was Dr. Raphael Wald, neuropsychologist from the Marcus Neuroscience Institute at Boca Raton Regional Hospital, which is part of Baptist Health. Rafi, again, thanks for joining us on the podcast. Any final comments, anything we missed that you want to state or anything you want to emphasize and restate?
Yeah, the thing that I just want to restate to people is get moving. As you get older, move. You're either going forward or you're going backwards. So exercise every single day. Obviously, do it in conjunction with your doctor and what they feel is safe and appropriate for you. But you got to move. You got to exercise. You got to keep your diet healthy. You got to manage your health risks. If you really are serious about decreasing your risk of developing dementia, you're kind of either going forward or going backwards. So keep yourself moving.
A message and recommendation after my own heart, and I say that with absolute pun intended. So thanks again, Rafi. Okay.
Thanks so much, John.
Okay. And to our listeners, if you like what you've heard on this or any of our other podcasts, please be sure to tell a friend or a family member about us. And if you have a comment or a suggestion for a future topic, please email us at baptisthealthtalk@baptisthealth.net. That's baptisthealthtalk@baptisthealth.net. We'd love to hear from you, and thanks for listening.
Find additional valuable health and wellness information on our resource blog at baptisthealth.net/news. And be sure to interact with us on our social media channels for live and upcoming events. This podcast is brought to you by Baptist Health South Florida, healthcare that cares.